I truly believe vulnerability is one of those things that is laced with so much power. And I think as men, sometimes we're so timid to go there. Today, I really appreciate the fact that everyone just went there. Amen. And it is true. I saw two Pastor Sams come up today because they were wearing the same clothes. I threw me off for a second, but but we all know Pastor Sam rocked it better, though. I don't even know who you are. I feel bad now, actually, now. But I do have to meet you. I've heard about you, Ricky, so Andrew made me say that joke. But, you know, I was going to say it was really interesting today. Did you guys notice we sang a worship song today that said that I am a rose, I am a lily? Yeah. Okay, let's talk about being vulnerable. We went there first before Andrew came up. We're like, we're all saying that we're flowers. And I'd never, ever had that as a guy. So I actually hesitated saying the words because I'm like, I've never said that. Like, I've never said, Lord, I'm a lily. So I never said that. But it was interesting because I'm not making fun of it, but it was interesting that in a space when God's presence was just moving in here, we just felt intimate to be with him that way. You know, it wasn't a weird thing to say at some point. It was just kind of like, yeah, Lord, that's how I feel. That's how my, but it was in the beginning, I was like, yeah, okay. Who's leading worship? What was your name? Matt. Man. Thank you so much, Matt. Appreciate that. So, like, what am I supposed to say now after all that, right? It's thanks for coming. You know, let's play basketball. Whoa. I'm just joking. I want to share with you, my sermon is going to be short today. It's an hour and a half, and we're going to, Pastor Sam said be men, so you guys have to suck it up here. But I'm going to try to keep it short because I think the important part of tonight will be what's going to happen in your groups. For me, again, it's not about me. I hope that I can just be a catalyst to kind of initiate some further conversations that would happen in house church or in your staff meetings or things like that. So my parents immigrated to Canada in 1975. I was born in 1977. My brother was born in 1979. We went to elementary school in Canada. And we were the first, I think, Asians in our school that I can remember. There was another Chinese girl, actually. Her name was Kathleen. She was second generation Chinese. And I was supposed to marry her because, you know, because I'm Asian. And all my friends, you know, I'm like, but I'm Korean. And they said, there's no such thing. It's either Chinese or Japanese. Because at that time, that's really what it was, Nintendo and Chinese food. And that's how they knew. Now that's what differentiated me, I guess. I was like, I'm Korean. They're like, no, what's that? But they said, either way, you're going to marry Kathleen because it just works out that way. But I remember, it's a funny story to think about now, but I remember this tension that I lived in at that time where I would go to Korean church and so my parents were of like in Canada, we don't have as many generations as you might. I'm thinking like this is America, actually. No. I just realized it's not where I'm in Hong Kong. In America, there's like further more generations, but in Canada, it's not so much like that, especially in Vancouver in the West. So we were one of the first immigrant, part of the first immigrant wave that came. And then there's a second wave that came when I was in high school. I remember going to church then, and the second wave of Korean immigrants who had immigrated when they were in high school, so they come with a lot of the Korean culture, would, you know, be at church, and we just wouldn't vibe. We wouldn't connect very well. And so they would, you know, they would ask me things like, so honestly, you know, if Korea and Canada went to war, who would you pick? For one thing, we know, I think Canada has one battleship or something. You know, it's called a ferry. Like, that's, you know, we're the peacekeepers here, okay? Yeah, you guys can thank us for putting a Canada flag on your backpack and traveling through Europe and you'll be safe, right? But literally, like, that, I would say, you know, well, in a Korean church, I'd say, Korea, no doubt, Daemin-guk. Like that's, you know, because I so badly wanted to fit in. And then I'd go to school, and then my friends would say, and my friends, like, they're Caucasian, But they're like Danish and German and all, but you know, but they're white. They don't, they look different from me. So it just, you know, but they're from different countries. But anyways, I look Asian, right? So, but they'd say, so look, if Canada and Korea went to the World Cup, which country would you pick? Korea, because Canada would not make the World Cup. I think the last time we made was in 84 or something like that. But, and so I was like, dude, these are easy questions. But the problem was, you know, for me, being a second generation Korean Canadian, I felt like I had a double blessing. I had the blessing of my Korean culture from my parents. I had the blessing of being a Canadian and growing up in Canadian culture. But in fact, the opposite had happened. Those two things actually became a curse in my life. Instead of being a double positive, it was a double negative. I know double negatives make a positive. But my point being, I know all the Asians here are like, it's not working, man. The math is not, you can't do that with us. So just pretend, okay? But my point is, it, when I thought that I could belong in two circles, I actually belonged in none. Like I felt like I didn't have a home. And so it was a big problem for me. Because, you know, for all of us here, we're all looking for home. We're all looking for a place to belong. And so I wasn't picked on or bullied, but definitely I just knew, I felt like I couldn't be understood in my Korean community and also in my Canadian community. And I felt like this, I just didn't feel good about it. And I really struggled with it a lot internally, just going like, who am I? You know, all this kind of stuff. And so what I did in high school is I just, you know, what every Korean person would probably do at that time was just listen to a lot of K-pop and try to watch. I tried to, and Korean dramas back then were not good, okay? Korean dramas now, like I think everyone here probably watches it in their closet. You're not going to say it, but you watch it, right? In the plane ride, that's when you get excited because you're like, I can watch some Korean dramas. But anyways, and K-pop and K-drama is like, it's the thing and all that kind of stuff. But when I was growing up, I just tried to listen to it because I wanted to feel like I could relate to my Korean people. And then just found out it doesn't work, you know, and it wasn't really working. I learned the songs and all that kind of stuff. I just felt like I still didn't belong. Well, there was this one day where I was asked to lead worship at an event, and I didn't really want to be there. And, if you lead worship, you can't just lead and then peace out. You got to stay for everything, right? And so I stayed for everything. And there was a gentleman who came from – he was a professor from Princeton Seminary. And he looked like he was like third-generation Korean, and he's probably about 50-something, 6 years old. I had never met anyone like that. Usually, around my parents' age, they spoke with a thick Korean accent or, you know, their mother language is Korean. But he had a perfect English accent. I was like, this is strange for me. But he was talking, and he said this profound statement that shook me and rocked my world and changed the trajectory of my life. And he said simply this. He said, you are not white or yellow, you're orange. And so the crazy thing about that, though, right, is those colors make beige. But that's exactly the point. When I walked away from that worship night, I walked away with an understanding that I was completely something other. And the point of that was not just because of my ethnicity. But he said this in 1 Peter 2:9. He said, you are a royal priesthood, a chosen generation, a holy nation. Because of Christ, our identity is not wrapped up in our ethnicity any longer, or our culture, or our relationships. But there's another citizenship that we've been given, and that's the kingdom citizenship of God. So what had happened was when he said that I was orange, he was saying that you are now completely other because of Christ. So what had happened in that moment, it gave me purpose, meaning, value, worth. So now that when I go into, so now actually when we planted our church, the Korean, we asked the Korean church that was kind of blessing us to leave, this is about 10 years ago, we asked if we can be mothered by like a non-ethnic church community, like a, I guess it'd be like a white church with a few Asians in it, but, you know. That's what they called multi-ethnic back in Canada, right? Anyways, but because we didn't want to have the burden and the the things that are tied to that, like the soul ties a little bit. So anyways, and they blessed us to do that. And when we planted our church, it's funny because we're not a Korean church, but now I have more access into the Korean communities and the Chinese communities to speak because I think I understand their context and everything. But now I speak with a place of confidence where I'm not just trying to fit in, but I'm speaking as a third culture person or someone who understands that I have kingdom citizenship. So this message today is simple. What we're going to do today is really clear and simple. Because one of the things that I realized quickly after I found out that I was orange is that I'm an ambassador of Christ. And so are you. The thing about this language, however, is we don't use this every day. I'm an ambassador. We don't know what that means. An ambassador was a highest official, trusted official, to go and represent a country. Well, in their time, in the biblical time, in the New Testament, ambassadors were sent to be peacekeepers, to help reconcile a relationship or help settle something that was not in good standing. So you would send an ambassador to bring peace. The Roman government, however, didn't believe in ambassadors. So what they did instead was they would send their army, conquer, and then send governors to rule the land. Like colonialism, right? That's basically what, and that's what they would do. And then all the ambassadors from the nations that they would rule would come back to Rome. So there's a stark contrast here. When Paul says, therefore, you are Christ's ambassadors, he's saying, look, in the light of what Rome is doing, world domination, conquer, destroy, and just rule and reign, he's saying you are actually going as ones who speak and deliver peace. Now think about this for a second, okay? As ambassadors, we're being sent out. Every single one of us here with a kingdom citizenship is being sent out. Now if you can think about this mindset, if we were all ambassadors being launched out, how different could church look like? I've had a little bit of a deconstruction thing happening with me in church. In fact, the past couple of years, our church has been deconstructing what church actually is and what it is, why we do what we do, and how it's built and how we can do it better. I don't know if you guys ever asked those questions, but we asked these questions because we were going through a moment where we realized we're building our church, but the city was not changing. You know, you guys experience that? Yeah, we have more church transfers coming, but the city's not changing. But man, we have a lot of people attending our prayer meetings. A lot of and our metrics for growth are we have, 200 people who go to church and then 100 of them go to communion groups. And that's our metric for success. But I don't see that as a metric in Scripture. In fact, for me, the metric now is when I see every single one of you who are the church and now ambassadors of Christ, and you're all called orange, the citizens of heaven, how are we as a church equipping you so that you can go and change the realms that you already exist in? And quite honestly, I think that's a tough question for churches to answer. We go to what we typically know best, and that's our curriculum. What I find with curriculum, and I teach at a Bible college, so I know, is that curriculum is typically cookie cutter. And the assumption is that all of you at this table, when you do the curriculum, will come out with an A plus B equals C outcome. And we know that that's actually not true. It doesn't work that way. In fact, our Western education fails in that regard, right? We just think it's like a factory, and everyone's going to come out with, whatever degree and knowledge, and you'll get that job. And so in understanding this whole ambassador mentality and that you're all missionaries already, do you guys know that, right? This is like kind of, you all know that y'all missionaries, right? Like not just the ones who are going on this mission trip are missionaries. Right? Okay, good. Now with that in mind, then how would that change the way that we do church and be church? Just some questions to think about. So for some of us, for myself, for me, I'm, a lot of times when people meet me, they go, you're a pastor? Because I think, I don't know what it is, but maybe pastors carry a certain kind of demeanor about them, or they dress a certain way, or they're more stoic, or I don't know what it is. But ever since I was young, I'd always get the, you're a pastor and you drive an Acura Integra. Back then, that was like, I should be driving a Corolla, because that pastors need to be suffering, right? Like that kind of mentality. If you have a Corolla, bless you, but I'm just saying, it doesn't mean you're suffering, but I'm just saying. But the perspective was when I had hubcaps on my Acura Integra, okay? I bought a spoiler. I think I tried to tape it on or something. That's how, you know, ghetto it was. But and honestly, I brought it to church and I got judged for it, you know? But what happened for me, the struggle of trying to figure out what my identity was and where I fit in, I realized that people were trying to make me fit into a certain mold and expectation. And when I'm not healthy or aligned in my soul, I play to those expectations. So for many years of my ministry and life, I didn't serve God, I realized. I actually served people. And one of my biggest issues is I'm a people pleaser. I'm an absolute people pleaser. And I used to just please people all the time. And that's because I, you know, one of my, if we're talking about the fivefold ministry, I'm an apostolic pastoral person. And one prophet said to me, we don't know very many apostolic pastoral people. They're usually apostolic prophetic, right? Set something up, prophesy, peace out. But for me, I'm like, set something up and I got to stay. And I got to care for these people. And, you know, but it's. And it was such, and so what happened was it was this dual tension in my life, and I didn't know what to do with it. I'd play to like, oh, someone's not feeling good about this, and you know, screw the vision. Let's stop and rest with these people. I'm going to share with you guys an honest, vulnerable story where we experienced a community of a church that we were journeying with, and they experienced some incredible spiritual trauma. Someone in the community had manipulated some people and established a sex cult, basically, within their community outside of their Sunday gatherings. Those people who were affected by that, you know, I'll skip a lot of details, but they, you know, left church, left faith, left God, marriages, you know, divorce, you know, because the person who manipulated them did the marriage, so is this even real? You know, there was a really disgusting and evil and very sad situation. One of the things I said to the pastor, however, though, was I said, would you be okay if we took these people in as a refuge? Like, we would love to help them heal up. And see, that's that pastoral side. And he said, yeah, if you want them. And because I think he was just in a lot of pain over what had happened and just kind of wanted to move into a next season. So I understand his response, but so we took these people in, some of them just peaced out altogether. Some of them would come into church and they would come in like zombies, empty shells. Everything I said was a trigger. God is good, trigger. You know, because when you deal with trauma, there's a lot of triggers. You know, if anyone who's been sexually abused or molested or you know, manipulated, just trigger, trigger, trigger. What this man had done in this sex cult was used what was called a shepherding movement and twisted some of the theology of being like, you know, spiritual fathers and that kind of thing, and took it to an extreme where it resembled what was called a shepherding movement, which was controlling everything about the person that you would call your son or daughter. So like who you're going to marry and things like that. And so it was really, really twisted. Well, when these people came into community, my wife's a counselor. I'm more of a coach, kind of consultant kind of guy. And they would come and we'd sit with them and talk with them. And they would just, you know, you can feel just, it's just really hard just to be there with them. One of my gifts and my values is that I'm an encourager and I'm a visionary and I'm non-judgmental. These are things about me. But when I would meet with these people, I was already public enemy number one because I was a pastor. So as a friend, they respected me as Teddy, but But as a pastor, they couldn't. It was just too much associated with that. So if I said anything that sounded like any preachy, cliched statement, which, let's be honest, we're really good at those things as Christians, right? Just throw it out because it's the truth, but doesn't help. And so, you know, I'd say things. And over time, as we kept meeting with these people over the past couple years, I just lost my voice. And then my wife turned to me one day. We're in the living room. And she said, "Look." She looked. It was like my, you know. And Andrew knows my wife. She's very gentle, sweet. But she looked at me. And she goes, "You don't know who you are anymore. And you don't know where you fit in." What had happened was all of who I am and was not allowed to be present in relationships anymore. And so I could no longer be that prophetic voice and the encouragement because I felt like I was going to trigger someone. Even when I preached, I was timid in some of the things I would say. I'd really try to find different language for it, but it just wouldn't work. It'd still trigger people. And I was always living to please people. I mean, I was trying to be considerate, but at the end of the day, I would start to lose myself and my soul and my identity, my worth, my value, all this other kind of stuff. Then it led us to a place where we took a 3-month sabbatical, and we were going to take it anyways, but we held off, and then we took a 3-month sabbatical this past summer, and we took the sabbatical, and God just refreshed and restored me. I hear a lot of you guys talk about being in rest, right? One of the things I was really learning was actually living my life from rest and not trying to gain it. And so much of my life was trying to get rest. But I start to learn that I need to work from that place of rest. And that's why Sabbath is so important. Sabbath is not church service, people. Can we get that connection out of our minds? Sabbath does not equal Sunday service. Sabbath is when you choose to rest, play, dance, sing, be. And I actually learned to do that. But guess what? In my 3-month sabbatical, it actually took my last week and a half to learn what that meant. Because during my sabbatical, I was like trying to tell everyone, this is what I'm going to do in my sabbatical. I'm going to read 6 books. I'm going to start writing my new book. And they're like, okay. But I just felt like I had to be doing something. You know, like, because I had to please the people that my sabbatical was worth it. And until I had to let that go. Long story short, these people are recovering. They're joyful. God is so good. He's so faithful. I wish that I can tell you more of their personal stories. I don't think I have the permission to do that to you guys. But you know, but all that to say, God was the one who was restoring these people, not me. You see, my identity was so wrapped up in other people. Anyways, all that to say, Saul approaches David when David comes down to fight. He says, look, you want to fight Goliath? Good, because I'm not going to do it. Even though I'm the leader, I'm sitting here quivering. I'm so glad you're here. And I'm so glad that you're offended by Goliath. So here, take this armor and go. My whole life, I took other people's armor. And these people who give you the armor, good intentions. In fact, for me as a pastor, I gave so many of our congregants my armor. Because that's what they want, right? They come up to you and ask, so hey, PT, how do I do this? What kind of job should I? And you're like, yeah, you know what? You should do this because it worked for me. Here, take this, take my sword, take my shield, and go. And we do this so quickly, or we take other people so quickly, other people's armor so quickly and easily that we forget what is actually in your hand, what's been in your hand your whole life. You see, David fought off a bear, a lion. He's been protecting the flock with a sling and stones his whole life. I think what God is going to ask you today as you start to unpack some of your stories is he's going to ask you, what is in your hand? What was in my hand was that I was orange. What was in my hand was who I am as a person, my values system, my map. All these things would come up. This was what was in my hand. If I was wearing Saul's armor and going into battle, then I would try to live someone else's life. And I would ask, what's in their hand? How did they do it? Don't we do that? Sometimes that's an easier question to ask because we don't want to deal with this stuff in here. So when I came back from my sabbatical, my answers were clearer than ever before. And so I had said, if Andrew asked me to come in February, I'd be like, heck no. Heck no, right? Sorry. I erased that from the... But now I just feel more confident because I don't feel the pull from every one of you. I have to impress y'all. This timeline that's in front of you is a story that I think Holy Spirit's been getting you to draw out. But you're going to notice things in your story that maybe you hadn't noticed before. You're going to notice things in the timeline that maybe it didn't stand out for you before. But I encourage you to be faithful to this exercise and do it again at home if you need to or whatever. Do it in your home groups again or whatever. But in your tables, when you talk about this, listen to each other's stories. Here's a rule of thumb. Do not interject with the sermon. If someone said, my life sucked at this point, let it suck. Don't tell them, but God's been faithful, right? You don't need to have a resolution to their story. Because we're so afraid of mess. We're so afraid of pain and vulnerability that we want a resolution. And that was my problem in my marriage with my wife. We've been married 15 years. I try to fix every one of her problems. And God's like, what are you doing? You're messing up what I'm doing. Do you know what I'm trying to say? I was giving her my armor to wear and not seeing the sling that was in her hand. And in fact, that's what my marriage today, it's always been a good marriage. Like and people look at us and say, oh, we want that marriage in your family. But internally, we both know it was actually during our sabbatical when it just went to another level. And I talked to Will and Sandro and Andrew about this at beautiful Tokyo Joe's. So good. I was talking about the whole value system and whatever and seeing each other's values or whatever. It's that kind of thing. So what I want you guys to do is go around today and just share. Actually, this is good. We need a timer. So someone be a timer in your group. And I don't know, what do you guys think? 5 minutes? Yeah? Right? Okay, so time. So everyone gets 5 minutes to share their timeline. And what you're going to do is explain the different events and peoples and persons, okay, in the event. And what's going to be interesting as you do this is you're going to start to see things about your story as you tell it. Like, wow, I never told it that way before. Can I share with you guys one story before you guys move on? I went through a massive betrayal in church one Sunday. This is my home church. I grew up in. My mother was the first Korean female elder in Canada. Yeah, in the Presbyterian Church of Canada, and I wasn't happy about it because I knew that she'd be like a martyr, actually, right? Because we don't have to go there, but they're not going to listen to her or respect her, right? She's just a figurehead. But I was a little bit nervous about that. Anyways, so that was his church, and then this one day we had someone come up to me. And I was going to preach in this English ministry service. I was a college pastor at the time. And they said, hey, can you preach? I said, sure. I was about to preach. And this lady walked up to me who I'd known. She's only a couple years older than me. Who I'd known for my whole life. She walks up to me. She gives me a huge hug and says, I can't wait to hear you preach. And I was like, oh, man, thank you so much. That same night, my father calls me. And this is just right after my wife and I got married. And says, Teddy, and he's an elder. He said, Teddy, do you know about this letter that just came up to the elders board? I was like, what letter? He goes, well, your whole leadership team signed it. I said, okay, what is it saying? He said, they don't want you back. They don't want to extend your contract or hire. And I was like, I don't know about this. And they kind of, in a professional way, slandered my name. And they signed all the names of the leadership on that letter. So then I called all my friends who were on leadership, and I said, hey, Danny, do you know about this letter that went up? And he goes, no, I didn't sign any letter. So we found out later that these two people wrote this letter because they want to have another pastor come in. I didn't want this pastoral position, but they thought I was lobbying to get it. When I was quite this is my home church. I can pick up garbage and I'll be happy. That was my heart, right? I told them I'd bury my grave. But anyways, I buried my grave there. Like, this is my family, right? And so anyways, we found out that there's these two culprits who wrote this letter. And, and so what the elders decided, they said, well, this is not factual. They crumpled up the letter, threw it away. Then we're having meetings upon meetings, trying to figure out what's happening here. And it was actually that one girl who came up to me that Sunday said, I can't wait to hear you preach, was the one who's behind forging that letter. So that, for me, was a super bad soul tie. So many things wrapped up to that. But what God had done in my story, when I drew out my timeline, I drew a dagger at first because it was like a dagger in my back. Because the image I had was her hugging me and a knife going into my back. But then the beautiful part of my story also, when I drew the image, was when Jesus came into that memory, he went onto my back as a backpack. And when I saw Jesus in the memory, I saw Jesus taking the blade and not me. So that timeline image, when I drew it out, was pivotal and key for me because it was almost like a before Christ and after Christ kind of moment for me. You see, this timeline could be like that for you. And after that moment, these people don't have power over me, those two people especially. We have yet to even hear an apology from both of them. One of them, the one who backstabbed me, she volunteered to do my wife's bridal shower. I think we were engaged at the bridal shower. Because my wife had moved from the States and had no friends there. She's like, I'll do, like, can you, like, and we looked at her like, there's something not right with you. But she didn't know that we knew. Like, she just kind of, it was just so twisted. And then they threw a farewell party for us. Like, that's how twisted it was, right? But the knife would just go deeper and deeper. But Christ, because he's a God who heals, redeemed that memory. So anyways, I hope that you guys can share these things. And what I hope to see out of this is as you share the stories, your connections to each other go deeper. Because I tell everybody, every relationship moves at the speed of trust, right? So you want intimacy in your groups. If you don't trust each other, it's not going to happen. And you can't force it. So what I hope this will help to do is help foster an atmosphere of trust in your home churches. Because now at least you know the story. And then now you know why they respond a certain way to certain things. Or when you say, hey, do you want to serve? And they say, no. You see in their timeline that they've been hurt so much by church. And there's there's less guilt and shaming. It's more understanding and empathy. Okay? So let's spend the next few hours. When you guys start weeping and, this is a beautiful story. And then, it'll go a long time. 5 minutes max for each person. Okay? And what you're going to do is just share your story. And then maybe at the end, what you can do is pray together.